Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, here we are today at episode 119. And this is actually the first recording being done in my new, air quotes, home studio. I have kind of revamped things a little bit, trying to strategically place myself between two dogs. And what I mean by that, and I want to say this being 100% transparent here, so I really do like my neighbors a lot. They're good people. I'm relatively fortunate here, I think, to have pretty good neighbors. But there's a dog situation, and they each, like, literally on both sides, like, there's these dogs, and it seems like every time I go to record, I mean, literally, it can be quiet all day, and I'll press the button, and then one of them does the, like, hey, I'm done outside, you gotta let me in bark, and I'm like, oh, come on, man, what are you doing? So I played around with some mic settings and things, and I kind of got it to where you couldn't really hear it, but I thought, you know what, I need to relocate anyway. I need a more quiet space. I need something more set up for a studio because, you know, I've been historically doing a lot of audio, and I'm like, you know, I need to bring in some video, like we've talked about a million times. So I thought, well, I'm going to take one of the spare rooms, you know, that one of the kids have moved out of, convert it to a little studio. So I'm probably about 60% of the way there. One of the problems and areas I struggle with personally is I do these things. I do this one where, like, I overanalyze something where I try to make it exactly perfect. I don't like to do things halfway. I don't like to do things that are okay or just good. I want things to be great. So if you watch a video, I want good quality audio, great video. I want the good picture. I want the nice background. Same thing on the audio side. You know, I started out with a cheap $100 mic. Then I made an investment to a much more expensive mic that has more dynamic sound capability and all kinds of other things. But I can get really wrapped up in making something so perfect that I literally do nothing. And it's kind of obnoxious, and it's just something that I struggle with. It's a little bit of insight on me. So anyway, I've got this space now. It's probably about 60% or so built out. I have enough room to physically work. I do like to occasionally say that I have a face for radio, but I have a face for podcasting. The nice thing on the podcast is, like, I'm wearing penguin pants. Like, these are like some, like, I don't know, house pant, pajama pant looking things. But, like, I can just wear the house pants. I'm wearing this Boston Red Sox. So if you're a baseball fan, I'm wearing a Boston Red Sox, like one of those waffle knit kind of shirts, like that long john material. So I used to travel a lot. Boston was on my my list of places I used to go, and I was up there one time for a trip, and I really, really underpacked. I did not bring anything I needed. I'm a big baseball fan. I'm an Oriole fan, always have been. My parents, you know, my mom was born in Baltimore. My dad was born 15 minutes down the road from there. So we have a very, very deep, rich, you know, family Baltimore centric kind of thing. So back in the days with the Orioles and the Colts and, you know, big sports town, sports fans, all that kind of stuff. So, but Boston has kind of been my number two team. It's kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. So everybody knows, right, that the New York Yankees, well, this is a family show. I'm not going to say the things I would say about the Yankees, but there's been some great shirts that the Boston Red Sox have put out over the years. We'll just say that. So I love baseball. And I absolutely have these like funny things that I would jokingly say or whatever. I love baseball. The Yankees are a great team. They have been for a long time. It's my understanding they didn't do so well in the World Series recently, but I don't really track that because I no longer watch professional sports for a whole separate reason that we're not going to discuss here. But anyway, the Red Sox have kind of always been like my number two team. And I thought, hey, you know what? When in Rome, I'm buying the Red Sox shirt. So I'm sporting my Red Sox shirt today, and it's just easy. Like, you can, like, literally roll out of bed and be like, oh, cool, press the record button, you're going, which is great for recording something that we're going to try and do a little bit more regularly during my three-week break between school terms here. But anyway, I'm excited to be here because I missed you guys and I don't like having big gaps. I like to be talking to you guys 3-4 times a week if I can. But this school thing, man, I'm a glutton for punishment. But I found that program. I was really excited about it and just wrapped up the term. I think I got a couple of A's, so that's pretty cool. But God, it just takes so much time and it's really, I don't know. It's interesting. So anyway, we've got a lot on the agenda today. I was chatting it up with some of the folks in the Discord room yesterday. And of course, this is one of the last things I did before I went to bed. I was reading through all the notes and the discussion that we had in the Discord room. And the point, a couple of questions had come up and I thought, you know, this is something worth kind of sharing with everybody. We need to get this out to the rest of the crew here. So of course me, I go to bed and I'm thinking about bees and I'm thinking about this discussion right now. And I'm laying there, I'm going, oh, we got to talk about this. Like an hour and a half later, I finally start to fall asleep. So first thing this morning, I woke up, I'm like, all right, we got to get this done. So one thing that we were going to talk about, kind of the subject, the broad subject of yesterday during our online chat was kind of like all the stuff that people tell you that you have to put into your beehives or do with your beehives in the winter. A couple of examples here. You have a lot of people who say, well, you got to wrap your hives. You got to get one of those hot water heater insulated wraps and you got to wrap them. Or you got to wrap them with roofing paper. Or you have to put fondant in there or pollen patties or granulated sugar or quilt box. There's all these things that everybody tells you that you have to do with your beehives every winter if you want them to live and survive and thrive. My disclosure before I start rolling into this is I always tell you what works for me. And when I know about something that is particularly good, great, not so good, whatever it might be in a different area, I will tell you, hey, I know some people or I have some friends or I've talked to beekeepers in this space and they tell me that they're doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. I'm going to tell you my recommendations and my experiences. And if you say to me like, hey, we're over here in New Mexico, what do you think for here? I don't know. I'll try and help you track somebody down that can give you that answer local to you. But this is why I've stressed for years the importance of having a mentor, the importance of having somebody you can talk to, someone who's local to you, who actually knows what really does work and what doesn't work. And this is a challenge too, because you might find somebody who's been in your area, been beekeeping for 20 years, but they're just not good at it. You know, and I tell you guys, I bring this up all the time, but it's one of those things that hangs in my mind all the time. And it just drives me nuts. This young lady, I want to say, I think her name was Kate, but she was out in Colorado and she was messaging us and she was like, yeah, my mentor says that like, that we only need to do an inspection like once every 6 weeks or something like that. And I was like, what? Like, no, you can't do that in the spring. Like you can't inspect once every 6 weeks in the spring. And then similar things that people have said around Varroa, it's like, oh yeah, my mentor says that we should be treatment free and we shouldn't do anything. And, you know, so that we can have all natural bees. And I'm like, oh my God, please stop. Like you can't do this. It's okay if you want to do things that are detrimental to your bees and you want to hurt your bees and you don't want to take care of them. That's your business. But don't give really bad advice to other people. You know, you have to caveat it at least to say, hey, you know, I'm a little bit unusual and I practice weird beekeeping practices, so don't follow me, but this is what I do. Okay, well, at least the person has some disclaimer. My disclaimer to you is I'm in the Mid-Atlantic. This area is the only general area, you know, within a couple hundred miles here on the East Coast that I've kept bees. So I recognize that keeping bees in Maine, Vermont, Michigan, Montana, Minnesota, if you start with an M state, you're probably in that group, Alaska, you know, Canada, Ontario, Manitoba, if you're in the Yukon, you are all going to have different experiences than what somebody's going to see down in Naples, Florida, Valdosta, Georgia, you know, wherever, Spartanburg, South Carolina, you're going to have a different experience. So just kind of keep that in mind as I tell you what I do and I make my suggestions. So we'll start off on the top of my list here. The first thing on my list I have is fondant and granulated sugar. there is a change in the bee's digestive system in the wintertime. They don't like to take in, they don't want to take in proteins. They don't like a lot of, you know, protein, fiber, things that require a lot of digestive effort. Because if you're creating waste, you have to get rid of the waste. Now, the rectum of the honeybee does enlarge in the winter to be able to have a greater capacity because they aren't going to defecate inside the hive. If it's really, really cold outside, they're not going to leave the hive to defecate. You need to be mindful about the things that you're going to give them. So we'll start off with the fondant and the granulated sugar. My first year beekeeping, I was doing what every other beekeeper does. I was reading, I was watching YouTube videos, trying to get all the information I could from everywhere. Lots and lots of reputable beekeepers, people that I know, people that I like, people who I think put out really good content, are still advocating for putting sugar and fondant inside of a beehive. This has been something that has just really driven me nuts for a long time. I had to kind of step back and be like, okay, let's really think about why, what's the driving force behind this? And I think what it comes down to, and I think the reason why reputable and respected beekeepers would tell people to do this is they just want people to have a good experience with their hives. As an example, let's say I buy two colonies from two different sources, nukes, packaged bees, doesn't really matter for this particular discussion, but I buy those and I have them, you know, at my house and I'm raising them all spring and summer. Winter rolls around and now I decide that I'm going to feed them over the winter. I'm going to give them sugar or whatever else I need to give them. And let's say they have great genetics and they stored all the resources they needed to get through the winter. Spring rolls around and everybody's like, yay, look at this. My bees overwintered. Wow. It's a good thing I put the fondant and the granulated sugar in there. So they are going to attribute the success of those bees, at least in part, to the fondant and the granulated sugar. And if something happens the following year, they may very likely say, well, I had the fondant and the sugar, but it must have been Varroa or must have been something else. What I try to focus on and what's right for me. Because again, a lot of this in beekeeping is doing what's right for you. Even though it may not necessarily be right for everyone, if it makes you happy, that's fine. My asterisk on that is around Varroa. Like, you can't just be like, well, I don't want to. No, you got to treat for Varroa. Well, we've talked about that a million times. We can talk about it more later. But specifically on this subject, I don't want to feed because as I've talked to everybody from the very beginning, we talk about those five traits and characteristics that I'm looking for in my honeybees. And the number one most important in there to me and for my apiary is the ability to overwinter. If I have to spend $50 per hive in supplemental food, then you're not overwintering. That's number one. Number two, I'm not giving you something that you're really going to benefit from. Number three, there's always this assumption that a number of bees are breaking the cluster to go up into this packed sugar patty area of junk and try to retrieve it and then bring it back. And that somehow is going to be the saving grace for the whole colony. Whole separate thing. But I want the genetics in my apiary that have the ability to take what is in the environment, gather enough of it, store enough of it for them to make it through the winter. That's important to me because I want to breed those genetics. I want to not worry all winter about whether or not my bees are going to make it. Yes, some of them aren't. It just happens. If you have 100, you know, I like to be at around, you know, 8 to 10%. If I can finish the year and I have, you know, 90 colonies left out of 100, I'm pretty happy with that. That's really easy to recover from. But if I have really poor genetics and I have to supplemental feed and I'm still losing bees and all the other expenses associated with beekeeping, which, by the way, is a video I'm actively working on gathering everything for that right now, to, you know, just all the detailed expenses of beekeeping. But I'm not doing that. I'm not going to spend whatever it is to prop up bad genetics. And like I mentioned before, I can see where someone's like, look, I got these bees and I just want to try to figure it out. It's hard. It's not easy to go from, let's just pick a state, let's say Iowa or Nebraska, and you get some bees from Georgia. those bees probably do really well at surviving and overwintering and being successful at being bees. They're being successful at being bees, but they're making it. Things are going well for them in Georgia. And then you put them in Nebraska and maybe not so much. It took me a few years to get the right genetics. I was buying my bees from Georgia consistently. I bought them from different commercial apiaries down there, but it took me probably 4 or 5 years to get the genetics that I liked. Then when I would order the package bees, I knew what I was looking for. And then if I didn't like something early on, I would just requeen them with some of the genetics that I already had. And then once I had a foundation, then it became a kind of a self-sustaining apiary. But as a brand new beekeeper, and maybe you have your first year, you know, 2 colonies, and what happens to a lot of people, you get 2 of them the first year, they don't make it, you get 2 more the next year, maybe one of them makes it. You know, you're constantly in this zone where you're just trying to get through, and this is life support. Someone's like, oh, this is your answer. So that's my big gripe with the fondant and the granulated sugar thing. It's like sugar, for example, take a bunch of sugar, throw sugar, you know, granulated sugar into a beehive in May or June, and tell me what you see on the ground outside the hive the next day and a couple days later. They're throwing that crap out. They don't want it. They can't digest it. They can't do anything with it. What they have to do is basically like regurgitate some saliva onto it to help liquefy it a little bit, and then they can drink some of the sugar. Now, if you put it near the top of your hive in the wintertime, you do have some condensation and things that will drip down onto it and make it a little bit wet. And, you know, the theory then being that they're going to go and drink that. Again, I see no evidence to support that granulated sugar and propping the bees up in that way is the way to go. Now, the one thing that I have done, I've done it quite a few times, is I always have warm days in January and February. If I catch one of those like 72 degree days in like February 20th or something like that, I'll open the hive up and look at the top. I go to the very top. If the cluster has already moved up to the top and there are bees really close to the top, I'll just slap 2 pollen patties right there at the very top and close it back up. And that can sometimes be the difference between life and death of that colony. I mean, I haven't done that in a couple of years, but I've done it many, many times. And that is one path forward. I don't use pollen patties a lot in season, primarily because, one, I do like the bees to be sourcing things in nature as much as possible. And 2, the hive beetles really love to get in there and mess with them. And I just, if you're maintaining, you know, 10 or fewer colonies, use your pollen patties all day long if you think it's going to make a difference for you. But outside of that, let them source what they need from the environment. Don't create a home for the hive beetle. If you put those things in there, check them every 2 or 3 days, because they will get nasty fast with those beetle larvae and everything.
Taxes was paying so much to get your taxes done every single year. Now Taxes is getting a TurboTax expert who will beat the price you paid your pro last year, so you get the most money back this year. Now this is Taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Switch to an expert now at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Proof of amount paid may be required. Must sign up by 3/18 and file by 3/25. Subject to terms at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
All right, so next on the list, I've got the quilt box. I've never used a quilt box, but I believe that the idea behind this is we're going to provide this big fat layer of insulation at the very top of the hive that is going to, 1, insulate, and 2, capture all of the moisture that may be created during the winter. So I'm going to address that in reverse order. There's moisture that's inside the hive that the bees will actually use and take advantage of. Scott Debnam, I think I pronounced his name correctly, he is a instructor. I don't know if he's actually a doctor, PhD, I can't remember, but he is at the University of Montana, and he teaches their beekeeping programs up there. And I saw a video that he did that was actually a really, really good video. In this video, I think if I remember it correctly, I think he actually drew like a tree and then drew the inside of the cavity of the tree. And he talked about the R values of what an average tree of a certain thickness might be and how the bees prefer to have a single entrance down near the bottom of this cavity. It was a very well done video and very technically accurate. But one of the points he made is that the entrance that the bees prefer is ideally slightly higher than the bottom of that cavity. The moisture that forms on the top of the of that cavity from, you know, just from their heat, and of course you have cool air coming in, warm air already there, some condensation. That condensation will then drip and fall down towards the bottom of that cavity. And the bees will consume that. The bees do still need water. They do need to consume, you know, water as part of their livelihood, staying alive. So having that moisture in that space provides them with something to drink. And like I said, I'll try and see if I can track down a link for that. And I'll try to link that in the description of the podcast here. But I still don't have a full grasp on why people are using this. So if you think about a tree, now you know there's a cavity. Probably most of the tree below the cavity is relatively intact. Most of the tree above it is probably still intact. So, you know, the R value of those spaces should be pretty high. The only thing I'm guessing is that this quilt box really is there, I'm guessing, to capture moisture. Like I said, I don't know, but you definitely don't want moisture dripping down onto the bees. But like I've told you guys several times, you know, I've used that vented inner cover, and I say vented. This is something that I've got to do. I got to do a big correction video on this one. It's called a vented inner cover. It is venting in the spring, summertime. In the wintertime, that vented space is filled in with a block of foam insulation. It is no longer vented. The foam insulation then provides you with some of that insulating, you know, R value that you want to get. I don't know what the actual number is. I mean, probably like an R. Geez, I think with the wood on top and the insulation, it's, I don't know, like an R6, maybe R8, something like that. I don't even know. But you're getting some insulation value of that. But you're also not getting the moisture. It's going to absorb, that foam will absorb some of the moisture. And the slight tilt in the hive will help to kind of keep it rolling towards the front versus just sitting in the middle and dripping down. Anyway, if somebody wants to make a case for me, like, no, here's why, Jeff, you're completely missing it. Here's why the quilt box is so amazing. I'm all ears, right? I'm all ears for new ideas, different ways of doing things and learning. But if it's to make things warmer, it's not going to make a difference, in my opinion. If it is to retain the moisture, there are better ways of doing it. I mean, because I think what people are doing is they're throwing some kind of like a material or a bunch of like shredded newspaper or like pine chips or cedar chips or whatever. Like, I don't think that's necessary. I've never used that. And again, maybe there are some places where it makes a lot of sense. I think you would be far better off if you said, look, I want more insulation. Build a 6-inch box. Take like a medium. Put an extra medium on top of it and fill that medium with a big block of foam insulation. Problem solved. Right? You rinse it off, you clean it up every year, and just reuse it. I don't know. Okay, now on to the next one is wrapping the hives. I definitely see some benefit here, particularly as it relates to the overall thickness of the sides and sort of that, I think it would be conductive heat or conductive cooling. So you have this air outside the hive in a lot of really cold climates. That side, you know, the sides of that hive are thin. You know, what are they, like 5/8, maybe 1/2 inch of pine? So they're going to conduct a lot of that cool air. So putting something on the outside, and even if being not just a wrap, like you can, a lot of people do like the roofing paper, and that's a great first step. I think the black and dark color of that will help to absorb heat. So I think that absolutely makes a lot of sense. But the ones that have that layer of insulation with them as well, I think that could be certainly of benefit too in the colder climates. What you'll notice here that I've mentioned a couple times is in colder climates, in certain places, like my friend in Nebraska, he wraps his bees up every year. He's had great success with that. I know Michael Palmer up in Vermont, he wraps his hives. I know the folks up at University of Montana, they're wrapping hives, right? In your area, if that's what people do, then that's what you probably should do. So I'm not telling you don't wrap your beehives. What I'm saying is if you're in an area where that is standard practice, and I wish I could gauge, because you have to do this in a scientific way to really know for sure, but being able to say, hey, I've measured temperatures in different places and with hives of X amount of pounds of resources going into the winter, and we have found that if your average daily temperature in the winter is below 28 degrees Fahrenheit, you should wrap with at least this type of an insulation. Anything below that or anything above that, no wrap is needed. You would need to really kind of do some kind of level of scientific experiment to really understand what that looks like. So to summarize all of those things I just kind of talked about here, I don't feed over the winter. I rely on genetics. I don't blame you if you want to try different things out, but don't think that that's going to save the day. Okay. I've had them eat little bits of it. When the, like I said, those first couple of years when I tried it, they ate a little bit. A lot of it was untouched and it didn't make a big difference. What really made a big difference was making sure I treated for Varroa. Pollen patties, if you get a chance to take a peek and the bees are working their way all the way to the top and they're running out of food, slap a couple pollen patties on there. Nothing wrong with that. Quilt box, in my opinion, no one's ever convinced me that there's any value of that. I'll never do it where I live. Might be a good fit where you are. Wrapping the hives, absolute value to that. Definitely recognize the benefits. If you are in a climate that dictates that you need to do so, I would absolutely look at doing that. Okay, so talking about feeding, this question came up yesterday, and it was actually a really good question. So the question was, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but it was basically, hey, if it's a warm day, because it was a gentleman down in Texas, and he said, hey, if it's a warm day, and you know, I want to feed the bees, is there any issue with me opening the hive up and, you know, putting in a frame feeder? The suggestion that I made was, number one, ideally by this time of year, like I don't feed. Like I don't. Get a nice day in December, January, great. But if I had a colony that was light and I knew like, oh man, they're probably a little light, I might be thinking about, you know, things I can do to feed. The one quickest, simplest, easiest thing I would probably do is just with the 5-gallon bucket open feeding, put it as far away on your property. Like if you only have an acre or 2-3 acres, put it kind of further away. It can, air quotes, encourage robbing, but this isn't really a robbing time of year. What happens is you put the feeder out and it's going to draw bees from all over the area to come and find that. If you're putting it near your hives on that one warm day, your bees are probably going to find it. Bees that are 2, 3, 4 miles away, they're not going to go that far, most likely within that one day, to all of a sudden now realize that your hives are there and now we have a robbing issue. Where that can become problematic is when you have these feeders that are there basically all the time in a fixed location, and now you've got your bald-faced hornets, you've got yellow jackets, and then you have other bees, and they're all coming there, and they're like, cool, this is great, all this free food. And then they start looking around and saying, oh, geez, while we're here, we should scout out a couple of these weaker hives. That's where it can kind of become an issue. But if you're just throwing this 5-gallon bucket feeder out on warm days, what I would do is mix it all up, put it outside, at least, you know, ideally 100, maybe 200 feet away from your hives if you can. If you don't have that much space, do what you can. Put it out there at the end of the day, take the bucket, flip it back upside down, right side up because it's upside down when you put it out to feed. I have a dedicated fridge for beekeeping things and, you know, so, but if you don't have that, you can put it in a fridge somewhere, or if it's going to be cooler, you could even set it maybe in the garage, wherever you can keep it, you know, relatively cool. But you can bring that back and forth. If you're in an area where you have a real variable temperature and it's getting to 65, 70, a couple days, every other week or whatever, you know, you can certainly keep that sugar syrup. I would recommend just remixing it up a little bit before you put it back out, because the sugar will kind of congeal a little bit. But you can definitely do that. I would not recommend, I think the gentleman had brought up the idea of using a frame feeder. Once the bees kind of seal everything up at the end of the season and it starts to get cold, the propolis will get kind of brittle, which while we're on this subject, this is actually a great time of year if you want to clean up bee hardware. Take that hive tool, and when it's, you know, 30, 40 or Fahrenheit or below, just take that hive tool and you can really easily scrape off propolis. It comes off in chunks and flakes and stuff. Really, really easy. Anyway, when they propolize everything shut and then you crack it open to go inside and add a frame feeder or to do an inspection on a warm day or whatever it might be, you put everything back together and it's not going to align exactly the way it did before, which could put you in a situation where there's a little bit of a draft now where some of these cracks were. What I tell everybody is if you have to open it up at a time of year where you still have a lot of really cold weather either to come or, you know, in the near future, just take a strip of duct tape, just wrap it around between that, you know, between the two hive bodies that you separated, just go ahead and wrap that around real quick. And then it just kind of covers up those little cracks you've made in the propolis. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think it's a big deal. If you just had a little bit of a crack, a little bit of an opening here and there, there's going to be some cold air getting in. It's going to happen, right? The entrance is still open, right? So you're not sealing the whole hive up all winter long. But it certainly won't hurt to throw a piece of tape on there to add a little extra seal. But the question that was asked was a frame feeder. And this is a little bit more invasive. If you started at, let's say, you know, 11 a.m. where you are and the temperature hits 70, you drop the frame feeder in, you close everything back up, and the next day the temperature doesn't get above 48, 50, whatever it might be. Well, now you're like, oh, crap, well, I got the frame feeder in there. They're not going to start taking up sugar syrup when it's really cold. They're not going to try to get that honey, or I'm sorry, get that sugar, air quotes, you know, fake nectar cured and, you know, ready for long-term storage, because they know it's going to be too cold to do that. So they're not going to take it up. So now you're in a situation because the cooler air has settled back in and you've got to get back in there and get that frame of feed out. So do you just open the hive up, let them get a little cold, yank the frame feeder out? I mean, you can. It's not ideal. Now, the single biggest risk you have when opening up a hive at a time of year when it's cold is a risk to brood. Young developing brood and young larvae are very susceptible to drastic changes in temperature. At this time of year, you shouldn't have a lot of brood. You shouldn't really have any brood. So that's not as big of an issue. But you don't want to bring all that cold air in there if you don't have to. So this, the frame feeder thing is a bit more invasive. The recommendation that I would make, let's say you knew you had, you know, 2 or 3 days of warm, you know, warm air coming in, warm weather, and you knew they were a little light, you just wanted to give them a little bit of a boost. I mean, you got to realize they're going to take up some sugar syrup, but they're not going to take up more than they and their teammates there are going to consume. You know, you might give them an extra day or two. They're not going to drink, you know, 5 gallons of sugar syrup and store it away anywhere. They're going to take some in, they're going to consume it, they're going to give some to their friends. And, you know, 48 hours from now, it's all been pretty well spent. But if you decide to go down this path, I would use a feeding method that I still really, really like, regardless of the time of year. And what you would do, envision a very traditional Langstroth setup where you have 2 hive bodies. And at the very top, you have an inner cover, and then you have your outer cover on top. What you can do is take off both the 2 covers, outer and inner, and then on top of the frames of that top deep in this case, you would go ahead and put your jars. I use old jars. I save jars, like, doesn't matter what it is, salsa, pickles, like whatever. Whatever I get, if it came in a jelly, like whatever, if it came in a jar, I jokingly tell my kids all the time, I'm like, well, I save all these jars because, you know, they're going to be hard to find after the war. But the reality is, like, I use them for everything. I use them in my garage for screws and nuts and bolts. And like, if you ever do any stick welding, I'll have like extra sticks. Like, I'll burn down 3/4 of a stick. Well, I don't want to throw away that last little bit. So I'll just drop it in a jar, you know, like throw a couple of those, what do they call them? Those little packets of dryer things. I can't, like, something condensate. It's not incandescent, but those little things that absorb moisture. But anyway, I save jars for everything. Take these jars, take a nail, like a 10 penny nail or something like that, and just tap the nail on the top a little bit and just make some small holes, you know, 6, 7, 8, whatever, in the lid of the jar. Fill the jar up with sugar syrup. You can put 1 in there, you can put 4 in there, whatever you want to do. Support them on some shims or something that allows the bees to get good access underneath and access to the holes that you made. And then put those on, you know, like I said, on top of those frames. Put a hive body around that. A medium is usually good enough for this. If you're using a big, tall pickle jar, you might have to use a deep, but medium's usually fine. And then put your inner cover, outer cover back on, and now you've got a food source for them. If the temperatures drop and you're not able to get there in time, you can come back a day or two later and just really quickly open the top, take everything off, drop your inner outer cover back on, and you're back in business. So that's another great way to feed. It's a really good feeding solution year round. Well, not year round, but, you know, all season long, you know, April, May through September, October, whenever you might need to feed. It's still a great way to feed. You just need to be mindful of the fact that if you're doing this in the spring and they run out of space, they're going to build comb all over and around that, and it can get a little messy. So you want to pay attention and kind of stay on top of that. So I was getting ready to wrap up, and then I glanced down into the Discord room here, and I see that Jose left a message, and it says, "Good morning, Jeff. Can you touch on how to trap pollen and how much trapping is too much? Everyone wants poly for their acai." I think what they call it, acai bowls, A-C-A-I. I've never done any of the pollen trapping. There are certain types of entrances and bottom boards and things you can do. And I guess so the benefit here, obviously, if you want to, you know, sell it to people who, you know, want to put it in their foods and things, you can certainly do that. But what you can do with this is gather up all of the pollen that you've trapped in these, and then you can kind of give it back to your bees at times of year. Like, for example, at my place, you know, mid-June through mid-August, roughly, early August, we have about 6-7 weeks of a dearth. There's nothing available. If you wanted to feed them sugar syrup and you wanted to mix in some good natural pollen with it, that would be a good use case for that. I typically will use a synthetic pollen that is, you know, it has all the essential amino acids and all that kind of stuff. My mindset is if the bees are coming in with it, they've gathered it because they need it. They've worked hard to get it. I don't want to do anything that might take that away from them. So that's where if I'm feeding, I'll use the synthetic stuff. But, you know, if that's the approach you want to take, and because you got to remember, like, they're going to keep gathering. They're not going to get to a point where they go, "Oh, we've got enough. There's still a flow on, but we're going to go ahead and quit." They won't do that. They will keep going until they die. If you have a time of year where there is a massive surplus, like if you look in your hives and things are really packed out, but you have lots of frames of pollen, they're probably not going to need that much. So if you can gauge that, this is an area that I have not really spent a lot of time in, but I can see where if you looked in a traditional hive of, you know, 10 frame Langstroth and you have two deeps and you literally had like two or three frames of pollen, you know, in each of those deeps and you had a surplus of it, this might be a really, really good idea for a way for you to naturally put some pollen aside. But anyway, as far as how that's done, I know it's entrances and bottom board. There's a certain type of a board that you can put in place where they essentially have to walk through it. I think it's an entrance thing that they walk through and it drops down. And you can pull it off the entrance, or there is something also tied to a bottom board component. But I'll make some notes and follow up on that. Well, folks, this is a bit of an impromptu episode, but this is kind of just what I want to do every day. I want to just jump in every day and just be like, "Hey, this is what people are talking about. You know, here's what's going on," and we can kind of have a discussion. This is what's the most fun to me, is to be able to provide real time answers to things. Which leads me into another thing that we're going to start doing. I was typing yesterday, and the guys are asking some questions, and I'm just, you know, hammering away at the keyboard. But I think what we're going to do is I'm going to start doing a live stream, and we're going to do it probably once a week, maybe once a month. We'll have to see how it goes down, but we'll figure out what works for everybody. And if you want to make a vote, like I say, go on the Discord channel. There's a polls section, and just go into the polls and just say, "Hey, this is the day or time that, you know," we have a couple different options you can choose from, but select something that works for you. And we're just going to go live, and people will ask questions, you know, put them in the chat, and I'll just answer them live real time. We'll record it and it'll be available to watch later on. So hopefully that way we can be more efficient, because I don't mind. I'll sit here on the Discord and I'll answer questions all day long and you don't have to pay me for it. Alternatively, if you prefer to pay for it, I can give you the contact info for a guy who charges $50 a month to be on his email list, where you get to email him, or like $600 a year to be a part of his cool club. So if you want to go that route, I'll give you his contact info, or you can just email me for free, whatever works best for you. All right, folks, well, take care, be kind to one another, and remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.